You are listening to the This Life podcast with Dr. Drew Pinsky and me, Mike Catherwood.
That's right. We're doing it this time. So check it out. Thanks for listening.
You live.
Hey, everybody. It's Dr. Drew. Welcome to another This Life, hashtag you live. Mike Catherwood is our guest host today. And we have, again, from the Dopey podcast, our friend Dave.
Dopey Dave in the house.
I prefer Dave from Dopey.
Yeah, it doesn't sound as good, does it? Yeah, sorry about that.
I think I'm going to take you off the short list for potential guests. How are you doing?
I'm great, man.
Excellent.
I am doing great. I'm doing better than you, I guess, because you had a tooth extracted.
Tooth extracted, coming off of the fever. But the upside was that fever. I didn't work for a little bit, which was nice.
Fever
a lot
from
of time
what? Fever from what?
I think my kids both got sick the last couple weeks. And then when the tooth got extracted, my immune system got compromised. But you would know better than me.
Did you have any? Well, you could have got an infection in your gums or your bone. But
there was no infection. You know what it was? It was something called a liver blood clot in my mouth where it bled in this disgusting, like, patty of congealed blood in my mouth for a day.
Right.
It was just disgusting.
And,
You familiar with this kind of thing, Doctor?
Sure. No painkillers for you?
No painkillers.
Attaboy.
Talk about that.
But,
we should talk about that a little bit.
Well, what I was going to ask is, and I think this is something that's important to get from the non-physician, and that is, you mentioned your kids, Dave. I have this ongoing argument with myself. How are you going to address addiction to your children, and when is the right time?
It's an amazing question. It's an amazing situation. Actually, today, my eight-year-old, me and my partner were not together for 5 years or something. Mm-hmm. And we weren't together because I was pretty much in and out. You know what I mean? I was not clean. And I never explained that to my eight-year-old. And this morning, we've been back together for 3 years, and I've been clean for 3.5 years. And this morning, my eight-year-old was like, well, why didn't you live with us? And it was the first time it popped up, and my partner was like, well, Daddy was sick. And my daughter was like, well, what did you have? And I'm very close with my eight-year-old daughter, and sure, it's on the tip of my tongue to tell her. But I don't think she's ready to really hear it.
I think you can get a little bit into it. I do.
How would you recommend it? Because I was a little bit dumbfounded, and I didn't want to – well, you know, I have a great relationship with her, and I didn't want to fuck it up.
I would start with the brain condition. Like my brain wasn't right. It caused me to do certain things that were sick, and I went away and got treatment. Keep it very matter of fact.
We did. We said it was a mental thing, and my she's
I wouldn't
not
even
my
say,
wife.
I wouldn't say mental. I wouldn't even say mental. I would say brain, and stay very concrete in your descriptions of it.
All right, I'll try that. Yeah. I mean, we're gonna. When do you guys suppose it's right to tell a child of your addiction?
It's any age is appropriate to talk about brain conditions. Okay, so all kids want to know is why, and they're thinking about why is again very concrete. So I was sick, I had a brain disorder, it required me to go away to get treatment. All they really want to know, I'm telling you, Dave, all they really want to know is, are you okay? That's really
right,
all
well,
they're
that's
asking.
What you wanted to know.
Yeah, that's all they're that's asking. Are you okay? Yes, I'm okay. Then, but what you got to follow that with is, if you have any more questions for me about what this was, please ask me anytime. I'll happy to describe. It's kind of complicated, but if you want to know about it, I'll be happy to tell you. So tell her it's complicated. I'll tell you if you have questions. Always say, more questions, come to me.
But when do you reveal drugs?
When she starts asking those, as she leads you into that topic.
Well, it's like it's the next question.
Yeah.
Well, is it? She's going to say.
Yes. She says, what happened? What is this condition? You know, she said that. And I said, I'm not going to tell you. I said, I give it a few years.
Yeah. Well, you can say, I'm uncomfortable talking about it. I'm still myself have feelings about it, but I will be happy to tell you. It has nothing to do with you. It's something that it's in my brain, and it was a brain thing. It's going to be hard for her to understand, you know, brain and using. That's not going to be an automatic connection for her. So delaying it is fine, but don't hide it.
My daughter's only 4, Dave, so I mean, I definitely have it easier than you.
Damn, I am not hungry.
I told you, man. I told
but
you.
But also, my head's blown off.
I'm 4.
He's having me suck on these nicotine pads.
Yep.
How do you keep that thing in your mouth? My head is coming off.
I'm a drug addict. That's
dude,
how.
You are, man. I am a light. I'm a lightweight.
What's that?
You smoke still?
No, I don't. I don't. I mean, I desperately want to.
When did you stop smoking?
2003.
And have you just desperately wanted to smoke since then?
Yes. I mean, not every second
sure
of every day.
Sure, there's not amphetamine in there?
I'm sure there's not amphetamine in there, Dr.
Jesus.
Drew. I not every second of every day, but I definitely – that's the thing that I get these periodic urges for in comparison to drugs and alcohol where I deal with it in a monolithic sense. I don't get these – urges, whereas I'll be driving down the street.
Now
I'll
when
see
you're
someone,
using this shit.
I'll see someone
you're
smoking.
You're not having more urges when you're using this stuff.
I'll drive down the street. I'll see someone smoking. I mean, I have an urge, an actual urge. But I
no,
just,
I get the same thing with cigarettes, and I don't with drugs and alcohol too. Let's get back to your daughter. I didn't mean to.
Well, you got to remember something. Mike's a stimulant addict, and stimulants are about cravings and urges more than opiates.
Yeah,
opiates is about thinking. Your thinking gets fucked up and takes you back. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. With
now, Mike, tell me about your daughter.
Well,
I hear this.
I kind of had a little cheat out of it because my brother-in-law, my wife's brother, has dealt with alcoholism, and he actually lost his legs from.
Oh, was he drinking that?
Yes,
I did not know that.
He got in a train accident, and when he was drunk, he was blackout drunk, and he fell on train tracks in Prague and lost his legs. And so she knows that story. We were very open with my daughter about that story. So I kind of use that as an end around to discuss the idea that some people can't drink alcohol. We don't do it when
that's a great way to approach
Uncle
it.
Andre and your father are people that we can't do it. And I also used I told she has a friend at her school. I think like every little kid nowadays in America who has a peanut allergy, and he has to have when they have treats at school. They have to make special ones for him, and I said, "You know how your friend Mickey he can't have peanuts because his body reacts in a negative way and he gets real sick." I said, "That's the way Papa is with alcohol."
Dave, that's a great way to approach it. Again, it's concrete, very concrete. You don't need to get into mental. Don't worry about mental until she's about 12.
I'll be like, darling. Whenever I take heroin, I just break out in handcuffs.
I break out in hives.
handcuffs.
I break out in handcuffs is the best.
You never heard that?
That is the best analogy possible.
Yeah. No, so
Nora, I just if you put Klonopin in front of me, I just can't. It doesn't do well with my biochemistry.
It's like peanuts. It's like peanuts
Dad.
For you.
You have an allergy of the mind and body.
I have a question.
And by the way, allergy is a great way to describe it with kids. Adult, I don't like the allergy analogy. Yeah. But go ahead.
I have a question for an opiate addict because you know I luckily escaped any real chemical desire to do opiates. I did. I messed with heroin and I enjoyed smoking it mixed with cocaine. But I was not a opiate addict. Now
I can't feel my hands. Is that one of the side effects?
I can't imagine being myself and then looking around and seeing hundreds of thousands of Americans dealing with an addiction to like synthetic methamphetamine or something.
Right,
you know
right.
what I'm saying? Like,
well, you've got it with Adderall right now. People taking that, so
right, but they're not throwing their lives away.
Right.
By and large, you know.
Then
so
they quickly get to opiates.
What does it look like to you? I mean, from your perspective, do you just have your hands in front of your head in like agony, seeing that, you know, opiates, something that you fell victim to, now is practically an epidemic in this country.
Practically. It is an epidemic.
And, okay.
I think it's a pandemic.
Yeah, I agree with you.
To be honest, I feel like I dodged a bullet. I think when I was using, I would get the most irrational feeling, which was jealousy that these people could get pills from doctors.
Not
and
irrational.
Use them they wanted.
It's exactly what I said. That's opiate addiction. You don't get that stuff.
No, but I totally relate. Yeah. I can understand. If people told me that they had an amphetamine prescription, I'd be like, what? You motherfucker!
I will tell you, in a treatment center, when you're treating patients and somebody sneaks a drug in, what you get is tremendous emotional outbursts. The patients all saying, oh, that guy is endangering me. He's endangering me. Oh, my God, my sobriety. And then when you get them to calm down and really talk about it, well, God damn it, he got to use it. He didn't share it with me or he got to use it and he's still in treatment. They really get jealous is really what they're experiencing, even though they don't even kind of know it.
I wouldn't be even surprised if part of my reaction to Suboxone is related to jealousy.
Yep.
Like,
yep.
I think I have a big mixed reaction to Suboxone for a bunch of reasons, but I know a piece of it is jealousy.
That's interesting.
Because they get to use. Yep. I mean, and it's fucked up.
Yeah.
It's like a base reaction. I also feel sad about Suboxone because they don't get to enjoy being clean.
Yeah. Well, they could, you know, right? I mean? They could if they're in the right hands, right? This is the problem I have with Suboxone, is that how do you select the person that can't go for sobriety, and how do you get the person that should be selected for sobriety, and then what do you do with that person once you've got them on Suboxone? It's hard.
From an outsider's point of view, though, you could say, well, who's right for Suboxone? No one would have been more right for Suboxone than Bob Forrest.
Correct.
You know what I'm saying? So, but then
and Shelley, and but, both of them say they'd be dead if they'd gotten
exactly. Yeah. So my point is that
that's why I don't know.
A doctor, a trained physician, can say, "Well, this person is right for it," but then they're missing out on the ability to get the real.
You're missing my point. We don't know how to select the right person yet. We really don't know. But this is the problem. We really don't know. Now, people would argue that they do, and that using anything other than Suboxone is dangerous and malpractice. And they're saying that now. But it's one of the reasons I'm out of the field right now, is because this scares me.
Yeah.
It really scares me. I'm thinking about going back in, and it's one of the scariest things to me, because I know I'm going to have to use Suboxone. But once you get people on it, and if you don't use it on everybody, you're malpractice. Right. Holy crap, man, this is dangerous. I mean, your buddy who we recently lost, Dave, I don't know if you want to tell that story a little bit.
Sure. I don't know, like, I want to say 8 years ago, I went to rehab and I met this guy at rehab. His name was Chris, was crazy, funny drug addict who actually Dr. Drew had treated 10, 15 years before.
Do you know the story?
Yeah. Me and him hit it off, on and off. We were friends through relapses and, you know, getting straight again. And he had a few more years clean than I did, and he helped me get clean. I was a creative person and I was working on a bunch of projects, and Chris was always like, I want to do a project with you. So I was like, dude, we should do a podcast. And he was like, what would it be on? And I would be like, it would just be war stories, be the most fucked up war stories ever. And we would call the podcast War Stories. And it turned out there was a military podcast called War Stories. So we called it Dopey. And Chris and I did Dopey for 3 years.
He was sober most of the whole time.
Supposedly he was sober the whole time.
He was definitely sober when I talked to him.
When you were there, he was clean as a bean, right? Yeah. He's wearing his little Brooks Brothers shirt.
Yeah, he has a whole. I mean, his story is epic. He gamed the psychiatric system as well as the addiction system.
Terrible.
Yeah, it was terrible, but it was sort of incredible more than terrible.
Well, it was incredible until whatever happened inside of him happened, and
I still smell Adderall in the mix. I smell it.
I don't think so. I think he went straight to painkillers.
Dave, I just smell it because he was in school. He was overwhelmed. He needed to focus. The move of the opiate addict is to go, I'm going to go to a doctor. They're going to give me something non-addictive. Here's Adderall. Perfect.
But I think Chris was so beyond that stuff, like in terms of. He wanted to shoot cocaine and heroin. He didn't want to take Adderall. He wound up shooting cocaine and heroin. And like, I don't think he would have pussyfooted around to get there. I don't know exactly what happened.
He was getting his PsyD, right? Is that what he was getting?
He was getting his PsyD. He had just finished his master's. Dopey was on the rise. He has a beautiful girlfriend who was in Harvard Medical School. He was managing a sober house in Great Barrington. And he was enjoying his life. And then I think for a minute, for a week or two, he was really enjoying using with all this stuff. And then all of the stuff of addiction came back and he was miserable and despondent. And within a month, he was dead.
Oh, my God.
You know? Yeah, it was bad. It was really bad.
And
he was the greatest guy.
It's great. Just another painful reminder that this is fatal disease. Yep. A fatal disease.
Commonly fatal. This is a fatal. This is what people don't understand. Commonly fatal.
That's the thing. It's like I've since then, and right before Chris died, another one of my best friends had died. Before that, our first intern had overdosed. Since then, another listener died and another listener died. So we're talking about, you know, I'm sure thousands of people have been dying, but my podcast is relatively small. And all of these people are dying at once, which tells me if you're fucking with opiates, there's a really good chance that you die this year.
Well, this is, you know? this is the reason people get on Suboxone and Methadone and Naltrexone and other things, is to because of that data. That's what
right, and I want people to stay alive. Yeah. I just have this listener, this Canadian listener who's really cool. He's been off all of drugs except for Suboxone for 3 years. He has a 3-year-old kid, and he wants to get off Suboxone.
Maybe he shouldn't.
He's terrified about the kick.
Maybe he shouldn't.
He's terrified.
But maybe he shouldn't. Maybe he should get down to the lowest possible dose. This is the part that I'm clinically unsure of, that my peers would say, why would he even think about getting off? It's too dangerous. I think, like you, Dave, that to be truly flourishing in your sobriety, you have to be drug-free. On the other hand, there is an intermediate step where you could get down to a low – I've seen people on very low doses where I really can't tell they're on it. I'm sure they can kind of tell, but probably to the point that it's not meaningful. So that needs to be the goal for him. Get on as low as possible.
I feel like that with the Suboxone distribution, and I know next to nothing about this, but from everybody that I talk to, there isn't a dose that's low enough to be as superfluous as you want it to be. Like it's like 0.5.
Yes and no. Yes and no. So for some people, maybe yes, and for some people, maybe no, and we don't know for real. I mean, there are people who will make the claim that they know, but we really don't know.
I make dopey now without Chris, and I get whoever I can on to come on. And Mike, you're welcome to come on if you ever feel like it.
I would love to.
And Dr. Drew, of course, the invitation is always out for you. But the point is, I'm doing my best with friends and whoever I can, and our listeners are very in touch with us, and it's a very cool thing. The community is growing, and there's a lot of support, and I love that.
Yeah.
Mike has an emergency.
Yeah.
He has to go.
No, I know he had to go.
But what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you the emails that we have, and you and Dave can address those,
okay,
and we can discuss it,
sure,
and we can take questions on Facebook.
Perfect.
But well, let me say though, Dave, I'm really, really sincerely sorry to hear about what happened to your partner Chris.
Yeah.
And I what you do with the Dopey podcast is fantastic, and
we love the Dopey podcast.
I really wish you nothing but the best, and it was a pleasure to talk to you, albeit too briefly.
Right on.
So
you too, Mike.
You stay with me, man. Mike, you get out of here. Good luck,
back,
man. If you or someone you know is dealing with addiction, someone you love, finding treatment is difficult. It's very frustrating. It is a minefield out there. And the truth is, every patient's needs are different and evolving. People behind True Recovery in Orange County, California, realize that effective care is not one size fits all. That's why they have developed a comprehensive range of treatments that can address all facets of this disease. True Recovery's master-level clinicians maintain small caseloads. They personally manage your case, allowing them to personalize the care. They offer individualized treatment plans from residential to outpatient, and always with an eye on a holistic approach and a focus on accountability. And as patients become ready, this is a key part of what True Recovery offers. They offer assistance with life and coping skills, school and vocational coordination, as well as community reintegration support and aftercare. I've spoken with the medical director at True Recovery, and I was impressed with the range of therapeutic modalities and psychiatric services. Their experienced team is well-equipped to manage patients at all levels of care. To request information how True Recovery can provide you the personalized care you need, go to drdrew.com/true. Again, that is drdrew.com/TRUE. Well, it's hard to believe a year has passed since one of the worst cold and flu seasons on record, but here we are again. So if you happen to catch a bug, the one thing every doctor will tell you is stay hydrated. Proper hydration eases a lot of the symptoms of many of these viral illnesses, and sports drinks, water alone, is not the issue. You need to be aggressive. You need something like Hydrolyte, full fluid replacement. Hydrolyte is this oral rehydration product you've heard me talking about. It's better than anything out there. It delivers the right balance of sodium, glucose, and water, providing up to 4 times the electrolytes sports drinks can offer, all with 75% less sugar. So think about that. It's like taking an IV by mouth. But my favorite thing is at the convenience. I'm always on the run, so I use the effervescent tablets. You just drop them in a water bottle or even a glass of water. I literally never leave home without them. No one in my family does, for that matter. And because Hydrolyte is appropriate for all ages, it's perfect for the little snowman amongst you when they come home from the school, perhaps sniffling. Hydrolyte comes in great flavors, orange, berry, and lemonade, available in a pre-mixed drink, a powder, or, like I said, those fizzy tablets. I love those. They go everywhere. Come in a little tube. Every package includes easy-to-follow dosing instructions. Order your supply today at hydrolyte.com/drdrew. For a limited time, you can save 30%. We use the code at checkout, drdrew18. That's Dr. Drew 18. So
either click through on our banner at drdrew.com or go to hydrolite.com/drdrew and then use that code drdrew18.
Dave, let's before we get to questions, let's do a little debriefing on my buddy Andy, my former patient, now friend Andy Dick.
We want to know all the dirt on all your.
Well, not the dirt. I just saw a lot of social media action, and
You want me to debrief you?
Yes, because you're the last one to talk to. My understanding was you brought him on.
Sorry about that.
He came on and was not sober, which guess what? People that have struggled with addiction are sometimes not sober, and people reacted to that. What happened?
Well, Andy, first of all, I don't know that he wasn't sober. He didn't sound sober. He was very funny. He was very generous with his time.
So he might not have been using it at that moment.
He said he was not using at that moment.
Okay.
He says he enjoys partaking in a drink here or there.
Okay. So
but
that's
he wasn't drinking then.
Right. That's his deal. His deal is his sex addiction and his alcoholism are profound. And he can't ever quite get real about either. He's always planning his relapse when he's getting sober.
Did you say his alcohol and sex addiction?
Yeah. I would say those are the two kingpins in his disease.
Well, he really copped to his sex addiction on the show.
Oh, good. Okay, good. Because he doesn't always cop to that.
The audience, hated him.
Why?
But I thought he was really good.
But what was the reaction? What was that all about? Well, I didn't hear it, so I want to know what your take is on what they reacted to.
Well, he didn't sound sober. He said that he was – when he would get clean, he would be as miserable as he was when he was using, if not more so. So why shouldn't he drink? Which is an understandable – kind of situation, you know. It's
like
as miserable.
First of all, anybody around him knew he wasn't that miserable, except that he was planning his relapse. His disease was calling to him, and he never is really in the game. He's never really fully sober. He's close.
Well,
he's always close.
I asked him about what being clean was like, and he started to describe it in a very beautiful way, like in rehab, swimming, socializing, enjoying himself in the community. And I think he didn't give it really a shot.
Yeah.
And I think the audience reacted to that. He kept trying to divert and help have me explain Chris to him, which the audience got kind of disgusted by. But and he also had his girlfriend there. And he had his girlfriend come on, and I made his girlfriend kind of uncomfortable. I asked her a lot of questions about addiction and stuff. Mm-hmm. So the two of them got pretty offended. Hmm. You know, it was a little bit, but at the same time, afterwards, Andy was very gracious and complimentary and said he had fun. And I thought it was kind of fun. He had a couple funny bits.
Andy, like so many addicts, is a wonderful human being. He is a wonderful human being with a very serious condition. And for people to sit in judgment of him in whatever condition he's in is, I think, terrible.
Well, it's a podcast, and the audience loves to troll and talk shit. They talk shit about me. Mm. They talk shit about him. You know, that's the name of the game. But I wonder, really, the question is, how do you get him back? And I don't mean as a guest. How do you get him
into sobriety? Well,
yeah.
It's.
He has a family. You know, he could have any kind of career he wanted. He's incredibly talented.
He's incredibly talented, yes. Yeah. I don't know the answer to that question. The answer in the past had always been get into a program and stay in the program, get enough time under your belt. That tends not to really work either, unfortunately.
Yeah, the answer for all of this stuff is you can't do anything but wish him your best, I guess.
That's right. And support him and help him in his process. He scares the hell out of me when he gets going. When he gets going with his alcoholism, he is, oh man, is he dangerous. Anyway, enough about Andy. I don't want to talk behind his back. He knows everything I'm saying here I've said to him directly.
Did he have his girlfriend on or his
yeah,
wife?
Yeah, girlfriend.
He has a girlfriend now?
Well, there's different – this is part of the this is part of the complications, Dave. Was it his manager ex-wife?
No, it wasn't. The funny thing was –
if she was 20 –
you know, I'll say this because he said it on the show. He said that he's not addicted to alcohol. He's just addicted to fucking his hot girlfriend.
Okay.
And then the whole show, you know, he's talking about how much he loves fucking his girlfriend. which is very funny stuff. And then after the show was over,
amazing.
He texted me, make sure you bleep her name because we just broke up.
Oh, right.
The funniest.
What I like is that he brings his drug of choice onto the show.
Uh-huh.
Which
yeah.
is
yeah.
okay. Well, you're right. That's the right reaction, which is
well, I hope he's more into that than alcohol these days.
Yeah, but one leads to the other. That's the problem. That's the problem.
Yeah.
God damn it. I love that
Andy.
Guy.
Well, what about Artie?
We all do.
Artie was a great interview.
Oh, you did Artie. That's right. Your Artie interview was terrific too. And Artie did a weird little thing on Twitter today where he came to the realization that people are worried and upset about his condition.
Sure.
Which he didn't seem to really realize, at least in that tweet today.
I didn't see the tweet. I've been like among the Artie trolls and I'm like, you know, I'm over the top with it. And I actually tweeted at him today to apologize for just bugging him to come back on the show. He needs someone to take. I mean, I don't know what Artie needs. I love Artie. I'm like ridiculous Artie Lang fan. I just feel like his treatment was too short. And while he was in treatment, they let him keep his phone. They let him go out to stand-up gigs.
Right.
Yeah.
Like he's tweeting from. Like, why are all these celebrities tweeting from treatment?
And he was promoting rehab.
Right. That's the thing that Andy kind of gets into too. Like 90% in, and then just enough to be out.
But like Bam Margera is in treatment fucking on Instagram. Like nobody let me keep my phone in treatment. And if I had it, I got in big trouble.
What
you
is
know, why does Artie go to gigs when he's in rehab? Why does Bam fucking go on Instagram to say he's not an alcoholic? What kind of treatment centers are these?
What does the big book say about that? Half measures?
They avail us nothing, Dr. Drew.
Thank you, sir. So, and I would even say 9/10 measures avail nothing, or 99 out of 100%. You got to be 100% in, unfortunately, with this disease.
I just love Artie. Like, I cannot put a price tag on the amount that I've always loved Artie Lang.
Yeah.
But recently he changed his number, which broke my heart. He texted me just before that. And he's always kind of saying these weird undercurrents about how he wants to be on Dopey. Like kind of like regular, but the reason that he didn't want to do it was because
he'd have to be sober.
He doesn't really, he doesn't understand recovery, you know. And my heart goes out to him, and I only want the best stuff for him. Obviously,
yeah. These are all, you know, whether it's Chris Farley or Andy Dick or Artie Lane,
Tom Sizemore.
These are all magnificent human beings.
Do we know how Tom Sizemore is doing? Somebody wants to know.
Haven't had contact with Tom in a little while, but last I heard, he's doing okay.
Yeah.
Last I heard,
he's working, right?
Yep.
So that's always good. So
no, it's not always good. But
well, I mean, it's better than just
– and I don't mean that specifically for Tom. I mean, generally, when people get to work too quick, it's going to be a problem. But okay.
Any other good guests that you want to share?
The great Bob Forrest is always coming through with some amazing dopey. Who did we have recently? We had Bob Forrest's buddy Chuck from Don't Die, who's like a clinician in Los Angeles. Coming up is son of George Hamilton, Ashley Hamilton.
How's he doing? How's Ashley doing? Good.
Seems great.
Good. Great.
Seems great. He says he's excited to come on. I'm excited to have him. Who else have we had of note lately? Oh, we had Killer Mike, the rapper, but he's not really an addict. He was great. There's really, really good stuff coming up, but I don't want to like jinx it, but there's amazing dopey stuff coming up.
Good.
It's going to knock your socks off, Dr. Drew.
I'm in.
And I think in February, I think Dr. Drew Pinsky might be coming back on the old dopey.
All right, anytime you say.
May be moving to New York full time, so you can be a co-host.
Producer lady. Do you have questions there?
You're coming back to New York?
Yeah, I'll be back in a couple weeks.
So we have a couple of questions on Facebook.
I want to come visit you at work.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
He wants free pastrami.
Let's go through some questions.
He's on this carnivore diet. He wants pastrami by the pound.
Let's go through some questions here.
Oh, shit. You know who we had that I didn't mention is fucking Mark Maron.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, I know.
Fantastic. I love Mark.
I knew there was a good one. How was he?
He was the best. Really? It was the best interview I ever got to do, and he was incredibly generous. It was just like – it was mind-blowing for me.
Oh, yeah.
And the way it happened, Dr. Drew, I didn't have a guest lined up forever, and I didn't know how I was going to get another one lined up, and I walked outside Katz's, And I'm like looking up at the sky and I'm like, I guess I'm just going to have my friends on. And across the street is Marc Maron. Like he's just wandering across the street. And I went up to him and I told him about Dopey and he knew about it because I troll him on Twitter.
That's how it works.
And he came in the next morning and I bought him a lox and egg and onion omelet.
Oh, he must have loved it. What is the best way to help my daughter with bipolar, anxiety, alcoholism, addiction? She's 27 and too old for my medical. We are losing her. So for this, Catherine, get your – you'll do anything for your daughter? Go to Al-Anon. Go to Al-Anon. Get a sponsor. It will change the dance you do with her. As far as her bipolar, hopefully you can get that treated. She probably wants that treated. Make sure they don't use any benzodiazepines when they treat her, but that will not stop her alcoholism. That she has to get to on her own. You and Al-Anon has the highest probability of getting through the denial on that. You agree, Dave?
I agree. Al-Anon is a great way to clear the decks and start over from a better, healthier place.
Well, Scott on Facebook also had a question about the alcoholic gene.
Yeah,
is it a myth or something real? If going to AA keeps people from drinking, how is it genetic?
It's the potential is genetic. You have to have the gene. Think about it this way. You have to at least like the alcohol. You have to like it in certain ways. All addiction has a genetic component to it. Like opiate, I could never be an opiate addict because I hate opiates. I just feel terrible when I take them. So that's a genetic – I'm a genetic makeup that mitigates against addiction. The higher the probability, the more you love the drug, the more the probability is getting addiction. With alcoholism, genetics are part of the story. There are multiple candidate genes. You can read about it. I mean, they have lots of data on this now, and there's epigenetic elements in it too. You know, one of the genes is the single amino acid substitution of the GABA, a proline serine substitution of the GABA A receptor, confers about a 60% probability of addiction. A LL allele of the serotonin transporter, also about a 60%. So there are multiple candidate genes that increase your risk for addiction. If you do not have a family history of alcoholism, this is alcoholism I'm talking about. I'll use these terms interchangeably, addiction and alcoholism. If you don't have a family history of alcoholism, you're not going to be an alcoholic. You can see the family history. It may be very mild, and if you have a lot of trauma and the alcohol works for you, you may go to the alcohol as a solution and then trigger what is not a very powerful genetic mechanism, or you may have alcoholism throughout your family, and almost any exposure can potentially trigger the disease. So there's differing genetic risk factors. But like with anything with humans, there's gene-environment interaction always.
How about heroin?
Heroin, it's you have to like it, right? You have to feel good with opiates, and so I couldn't be a heroin addict. Most heroin addiction is underpinned by alcoholism.
No alcoholism in my family,
right?
None. Maybe I had a great grandfather who was supposedly an alcoholic, but then decided to stop drinking at the drop of a dime. So I don't think he was an alcoholic.
Well, most heroin addicts now there's our genetic subsets. Certain Ashkenazi Jew subsets have a different kind of addiction than, say, an Irish heroin addict. That's a different biology.
Explain. I'm fascinated.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can do it with great scientific rigor, except to say that the only time you ever see opiate addiction or stimulant addiction without alcoholism is in Ashkenazi Jews and certain Han Chinese populations. It's the only
That's
time.
That's insane.
It's the only time. Every other what's that?
This is the worst thing. I mean, so this explains my whole situation is I'm yes. Ashkenazi Jew.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm not going to say it's an easier form of addiction. It tends to be a little more treacherous, I will tell you. When it really blows up, it's a cunning manifestation of opiate addiction. It's tough. But when you do well longer term, you tend to keep doing well longer term. That's been my experience. But you got to getting the sobriety going is very tough, as you know.
That's yeah, it really took me forever. Do you think that was Lenny Bruce's story too?
Yeah. If it's a Jew, it's Jew and drugs. It's a very specific subset.
So you know, it's not trauma. It can't be.
Well, a trigger trauma is what helps it along. Yeah. Trauma and attachment and other issues are always there, fueling addiction, fueling the initiation of addiction, mm-hmm. and then once it gets going, then you have this biological process going. Man, it's very challenging to get over these conditions. They are extremely, extremely difficult. My husband has a seizure disorder and a drinking problem. I'm really concerned something bad is going to happen soon. He takes all of his anti-seizure meds daily but isn't supposed to drink at all, but he still does. He refuses to admit he has a problem. Any ideas? Again, Lori, go to Al-Anon. Immediately go to Al-Anon. Keep going to Al-Anon. Contact his doctor and tell him or her that he is drinking, because his seizure disorder is probably related to alcoholism. Certainly alcohol lowers the seizure threshold but also causes seizure disorder. So you got both sides. Alcohol withdrawal causes seizures and lowers seizure threshold. So it's a very serious problem with somebody with a seizure disorder. Talk to his doctor about that, and then keep, you know, once you get in the program of Al-Anon, you'll change the way you dance with him. Hopefully one day he'll be motivated to get care. The people, Dave, talk a little bit about what it takes to get people to a place where they want to get better, because that's the real magic, I'd say, in addiction recovery.
Well, the trick is actually wanting to get better.
Yeah.
It's like, and I know that I wanted to get better forever, but I wanted to get high more. So if you have those two things kind of at odds, they always use that word when you're what was the word for when you're not sure?
Ambivalent. Ambivalent.
Ambivalence. They would tell me that I was ambivalent in treatment.
Yep.
And it was probably because I didn't know what ambivalent meant at the time. I thought they were saying I didn't care. Mm. But I was totally divided because I love to get high and I was so tired of being a junkie.
Right. So you're still ambivalent. You're still ambivalent. Yeah. That's right.
I was ambivalent forever. So once I wasn't ambivalent, it was very easy for me. Once I was definitely done and I wanted to get better. And it was really the culmination of many years of misery. And I had already stopped taking heroin for basically 5 years, four or five years when I got off of everything else. I had done heroin once in 4.5 years. And then I smoked weed every day. I did pills here and there. I drank when I wanted to, but I was like, I smoked weed every day. I did pills every week. I was still living a life that was not in recovery. I wasn't clean. The heroin I had to give up because I could not do it every day. And I would do as much of it as I could. So for me, once I had an inkling that I actually wanted it, I went to AA and I finally found a meeting where they wanted me to be there. They were incredibly kind and receptive to me being there. And they said, we would love it if you came back. And the fact that they told me that they would love it if I came back, I was like, I'll come back. It was a 7:30 in the morning meeting. It was on the lower, it was in like a kind of the West Village in Manhattan. And I went there every day for a year. And there were really cool people. There were a ton of junkies. They weren't all alcoholics. They didn't chastise me for talking about drugs. And I took their suggestions and my life. Within 90 days, my life got much better. I think if you have a habit, it'll take a little bit longer to get over the withdrawal and all that stuff. But your life gets better way quicker than you think. That's what I think.
Yeah, I'm reading a quote from the First Lady of North Dakota, somebody I've spoken on behalf of. She says this is a statewide stigma survey they did, and they found that 37% of those surveyed believed addiction is a choice. Wow. A man...
Who wrote that? When?
This is just a tweet right now.
Oh, I thought in response to this?
No, she just put it up there and it just caught my eye and it's like, I wish it was a choice. It'd be so easy and all you have to do is convince people they should make another choice. There's no rational, this is not a rational condition. This is an irrational part of the brain. This is a part of the brain that says do that or else, just nothing else matters. And you end up loving the drugs and alcohol more than you love anything else in your life, correct?
Yeah, definitely. I but the thing is that every time they told me it was a disease when I was in treatment or I was getting methadone or I was copping, I thought it was a choice also. I never thought it was a disease. You know, I thought like I was wired badly. I thought this is what I want. You know, this is me. And I just happen to be chemically dependent on these drugs, you know? So I don't think it's so weird for the North Dakotans to believe that. Cause I, as an addict who was an educated addict, it was hard for me to see it any other way.
How do you see it? I was out there. And how do you see it now?
I see it as a very, very deep and terrible mix. I see it as an affliction, you know, that is a terrible burden to a lot of people.
Yeah. It's like saying it's a choice to eat. Because you have hunger all the time. Yeah. Well, if you get rid of the hunger, you wouldn't be making that choice. But you understand? And so, to not use, you have to be really motivated and really clear and take lots of help because you're overcoming a very powerful drive. So,
well, you're replacing this endless hole with something else.
Yep.
You know, they call it the God-shaped hole. It is a hole inside of you that needs to get filled. And if you can fill it with something good, it's amazing that your body can respond to something good.
That's right. We have found this thing that fills that hole, but takes time. What's that, Susan? What do you got?
Sorry, my thing stopped for a minute. Somebody was asking how to get resistant family members into Al-Anon.
Yeah, Jennifer. That's like trying to get an alcoholic into recovery.
A lot of people don't even know what Al-Anon is.
I know.
And where to find it.
Like, it's as available as any other 12-step. Just go online. They'll come get you if you want. It's a program for loved ones of alcoholics and addicts, and they will support you and love you and show you how to deal with it because they're dealing with it too. And there's years and years and years of experience accumulated at Al-Anon that helps you, but through their age, it will help you help yourself in dealing with this condition. This is a really interesting question. It's a long one. I'm going to give it to you, Dave.
Yeah,
I think it's
a
good
one
for you. Are you ready for this?
But it's a good one.
Yeah, it is a good one. This is a 22-year-old son who's been off heroin since November 17. So what do we got? About a year and a half off. He entered rehab and was made sober. He got served a warrant for selling pills about 3 months ago. Let's see. He goes to a methadone clinic. Oh, boy. This is complicated. He goes to a methadone clinic every day, so she thinks he's cured now. So I don't have to be worried because now she doesn't have to worry that he's going to overdose. My son is employed. He has more opportunities. He's a small percentage of blah, blah, blah. His trial is 2 weeks away. If he goes to jail, I'm convinced he will use heroin again, essentially. She needs to go to Al-Anon, of course. This kid needs to – he can keep taking methadone in prison, can't he?
I think so, but yeah. I don't know.
I believe that's true. So he
maybe Suboxone. Who knows?
And usually we say that he needs to pay – if he were sober, which he's not, he's on methadone, which is okay. That's a harm avoidance. But a sober person would say, I have to clean up my side of the street. Part of my amends is dealing whatever the consequences are of my disease, which for some people means going to prison. That's what they do. Right, Dave?
Yeah. And I think prison could be an amazing tool for somebody, as sad as that is, because they can finally see what's happened.
That's absolutely true.
You know, clearly. So oftentimes when you're on methadone, you're not just on methadone. When I was on methadone, I never didn't buy pills the same day. I never didn't get dope before I fucking did my methadone.
But you were able to.
I would get up at 4:30 in the morning, cop dope in downtown Los Angeles, shoot it, and then get my methadone.
And you know, so I could. Were you able to work on the methadone?
No, I didn't do anything. Yeah. I just stayed at home and watched TV. My girlfriend paid for everything.
That's usually the case with methadone. How much were you taking?
I was up to 150 milligrams.
Yeah, I was going to say, usually if you're taking enough not to keep using heroin, you're on the couch. So,
yes.
You know, it's really tough for this woman. It's a very complicated situation. I can't really make a significant contribution to this case, except to say the cards will fall as they may as it pertains to his legal case. Hopefully, an enlightened judge will include some sort of drug court or some sort of drug treatment as part of his sentencing, if indeed he is found guilty, which he should be because he did something wrong. And hopefully he can get tapered off stuff and really get into genuine sobriety, or not, in which he can get on the lowest dose of methadone possible.
So wait, he got busted selling pills. This letter is from the mother?
Yeah.
You know, what my parents did, they didn't do Al-Anon. What my parents did is they went to something called Families Anonymous.
Oh, yeah. That's another group.
Yep. Families Anonymous, like, it saved their life from me.
Yeah. I generally, that's why I actually will sometimes not even use the word 12-step and just say mutual aid, because there's lots of different mutual aid societies that work out there. There really are, but you've got to have it's an interpersonal disorder, the interpersonal solution. You've got to have support of other humans.
She should know that my parents were the most overprotective, involved Jewish middle-class parents, and Families Anonymous was an amazing tool for them.
It got them to not be so enmeshed.
It got them to live their life. It actually got them into some weird gay square dancing society in Manhattan. But that's another story.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Let's see. I'm a 49-year-old male. I've been an active meth user for 31 years. Wow. Currently employed as a substance abuse technician in a 30-day, 24-hour residential. Oh, boy. Is my just being present there casting a negative light into the positive spirit of recovery and sobriety? Yes, you are. I don't understand a program that would not test its employees. You are seriously endangering the other treatment professionals there. And
he knows. He's being provocative, Dr. Drew.
Well, tell me more.
This guy is a jerk off. You know, he's like, he's bragging that he gets to go to this fucking facility high on meth.
Yeah.
You know, and it's obviously doing people damage. And people tell a story. But if you walk into a fucking rehab or a facility as an employee and you're high, you're doing damage. And chances are you're doing more damage than just being high. Chances are you're giving somebody something. Ugh. You're definitely not passing on anything good, you know?
If you know, we like to have people in the program and in recovery, in treatment, but they've got to be fully – my physician partner, it took him 5 years before he was ready to be – working around addicts. And even then, under very only slowly do we get him involved in it. It's extremely provocative to be working in the treatment field, and you've got to have long-term sobriety before you should.
Your thoughts about someone that's been stable on methadone for several years but fears tapering in the age of fentanyl?
Then don't taper. I mean, if you're okay, and this is where you're okay and you're able to work and function and you harm avoidance is an okay place for you, don't taper.
So
I don't understand that question though.
Well, if that person going to be tapered for methadone, they would have to spend a year in treatment. Let's be fair, right? And their fear of fentanyl is appropriate because they know they would use if they reduce their methadone. Does that make sense?
I was on a crazy dose of methadone for a long time, and I tapered for a very long time. I did like a milligram a week, or you know, the lowest taper you could.
You were using the whole time.
No, but at the end, I think at the end I wasn't because when I checked in, I think I was at 30 milligrams of methadone.
It's a lot.
And I was, yeah, that was they wouldn't let me get lower or something like that. I don't know. I think you can taper and you don't have to use, I guess I used heroin again.
You can taper with a plan of getting down around 20 or 30 and then getting into treatment, but you've got to be in treatment for a long period of time because the methadone withdrawal goes on and on and on. And you know,
I didn't go long enough. I got kicked out. Somebody threw in some fucking black tar heroin over the wall at a treatment in Tarzana or something. I wound up doing it, but I was blocked on the Suboxone. I didn't even realize it, and I got kicked out for doing dope while I was blocked.
Oh, I see. You went from methadone to Suboxone. Good. That's a good move. That's a good way to go. And then that can be tapered off. That's certainly a good way to go. But again, it takes a long time. Takes a long time, and that person's fear of so you can be transitioned over to Suboxone that may mitigate the fear of fentanyl, but you know what you're saying is you're going to use if you're not in a structured environment, and that's true. That is true. You would agree with that?
Taper works, but give yourself time and structure and patience.
I worry about it outside by structure outside of a sober living or a residential program. I'd be very concerned about it. This is dangerous disease. It's so dangerous. And she's absolutely right that with fentanyl flying around now, it's that much more dangerous.
I agree.
Yeah. Sorry.
So somebody has a question about alcohol. We're waiting to see what it is. But midstream, right when you were asking that really long question, the Facebook feed stopped. So I had to start it up again. And then the screen was sideways, and then it was
okay.
But anyway, so I'm getting people back on, and they're gonna get
right.
My question.
I'm a recovering addict and a single mother of two kids. I was wondering if it's possible to do a show on recovering addicts to show the world that you can overcome. Let's call it the Dopey Show. I believe that if people saw more addicts making something of themselves, then more people would fight for their life. What do you say about that, Dave?
I think that's great. I think anybody with an addiction problem, anybody who's an addict, can get clean. And your life can get so much better. I mean, really, like as I was getting amped up to do your show, the only thing I really wanted to get out there was that I had such a terrible life for so long, and getting clean made my life so much better. I have such a good time living clean, and like I live to have fun. You know, if I couldn't have fun, I would be using, but I get to have fun and be clean. And like anybody who is on drugs and wants to get clean, you can get clean and you can have a much better time than you did getting high.
Yeah, there's lots
and
of examples.
I did it.
Lots of examples. Huh? There's lots of examples of people in sobriety now. Lots of podcasts. This Life podcast, we talk about it all the time. We interview people all the time that have long-term sobriety. I mean, Bob and Shelley are good examples of that. You're a good example of it. I don't know. The fact that she doesn't understand there's lots of it out there, that sort of breaks my heart a little bit.
Everybody, when you're out there, you're surrounded by it. you're not, you know, recovery doesn't look cool when you're doing drugs. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
When you're getting high, recovery doesn't seem like even an opportunity. It seems like a resentment. Like, I know when I was high, people who were sober, I was like, fuck them, you know?
Well, there's a really funny phenomenon that happens with alcoholics and addicts is that there's something about the disease that has them experience anyone as trying to help them as trying to control them. It's so funny to me because the controlling is the last thing we're interested in, and yet that's the way it's experienced by the addict. Can you address that a little bit?
I think it's all like cloak and dagger that they will come up with any reason not to let go of the drug. And they'll say, you're trying to control me, but that really means you're not going to let me get high.
You're right. That's what it means, but it must feel like controlling to them in some weird way.
Well, I know that I was very defiant and I hated people telling me what to do. And I still do, you know, I still struggle with people who are controlling at work when it's controlling, family when it's controlling, but when you're out there and you're using, and someone is going to tell you what to do, you're not in your right mind anyway.
But let's break that down a little bit. Tell you what to do, I find already a funny construct, because you come to a doctor and a treatment team and they make suggestions to you how to stay sober. That's not telling you what to do. That's telling you what you need to do in order to stay sober.
You're talking about a place of complete and total immaturity.
I get it. I get it. But it's so bizarre to me as somebody offering advice and then being told you're telling me, hey, man, you're not the boss of me. You're not the boss of me is like, yeah, I don't want to be. I'm not interested in being the boss.
But as Dr. Drew, that's, I'm sure, where you're sitting behind the desk and the next client or the next patient that comes up to you, you can pretty much tell who they are based on the person who says, don't tell me what to do, or based on the person who says, I'll do anything it takes to get better.
Right. And that's the difference between somebody who gets sober and somebody who doesn't. Bottom line. Right.
Unless they're bullshitting when they say that, because I've said that a million times and I was bullshitting too.
I can usually tell the difference.
Of course.
But sometimes I can't. Sometimes I can't, and I'll just take them at their word for the moment, and we'll see how they do. Right? That's the best.
I hear you.
Susan, what do you got there?
For my severe pain, I was on Soma 3 times a day, Percocet 4 times, 754 doses daily. I was on that for 15 years, and now my doctor took me off and gave me no Somas. And now I'm on Norco 2 times daily. Isn't working for me. My severe pain is now – my severe pain. So now I'm taking more pills and running out within a week.
Right,
what do I do for my severe pain?
Right. So that's that.
And those are all in caps, so I had to read it.
Right. There are two options for a case like that. One is some of the pain managers might switch that person over to Suboxone, and they tend to do better. So Suboxone is one option. The other is abstinence-based treatment in a structured environment, again, and really go at the pain through a multidisciplinary approach, not just pills. And she's been on them so long that that may not work. So a switch to Suboxone might. But the fact is I treated probably thousands now of people who fit that profile or something similar, and they all had their pain go from a 20 out of 10 to a 5 out of 10 just taking them off the drugs. And staying, and again, doing a structured treatment with multiple interventions that go at the misery of pain, not the somatic component of pain, if that makes sense. Pain has two components. Pain is what's happening in your body. Like when you cut yourself, there's some sensory fibers that send information back to your head, but you also have a part of your brain called the insular cortex that fires off as well, which is the affective or emotional component of pain. And in people with chronic pain, that insular mechanism, the affective component, tends to be the piece that really drives the misery. And that's the part that doesn't get better with opiates or soma. In fact, it's perpetuated or made worse by that, and you can get better with other interventions.
That was a good one. Okay. She said thank you.
Okay.
No, she said in caps, wow, thank you.
Okay, good. She yelled back.
Okay. Let's see here. Thoughts about an
alcohol. So cool. Live questions.
Yeah,
I know.
Facebook
Live. We could start a new show for you, Dave. Okay, thoughts about an alcoholic in recovery about 5 years, that person smoked weed.
Oh.
This person also has been diagnosed with mental health issues, panic disorder, and depression, but haven't been able to overcome those issues. They just take prescribed meds. This person thinks weed will help their depression and keep calm. Any risk to their sobriety?
smoking pot?
Yeah.
Well, sure. Some people, anything that triggers the reward, the shell of the nucleus accumbens can reactivate the disease of addiction. Pot, because it's not so powerful that way, people can do okay for a while before they sort of find themselves thinking about their drugs of choice again. And people can be on maintenance with pot. There is such a thing just the way there's maintenance with opiates. But it is, for somebody in long-term sobriety, that person needs to talk to a sponsor.
That's
because
nice.
An addict should not be making decisions about their relationship with substances ever. Their brain can't do that. That's the nature of the condition. They have to use other people, their resources, to make those decisions. Even when a doctor says, here, you need this, check in with your sponsor.
So the doctor suggested that they smoke weed?
No.
Is that what that was?
No, but I was just adding that on.
Because, I mean, from where I'm from, you know, I loved weed. Weed is my favorite thing in the world. But where I'm from, I don't see how you can be sober in recovery and smoking pot. I don't think those things go together. Although I know a lot of heroin addicts who just smoke pot and they have, you know, productive lives, and mazel to them.
And mazel to them as well, because I don't make any different distinction between smoking the pot, taking the Suboxone, taking the methadone. These are all harm avoidance strategies. These are all ways of maintaining on something that aren't as powerful pharmacologically in terms of activating the disease as their drug of choice. So if they can get by with that, fine. But it's, to me, always a house of cards when people are doing that.
Yeah, I just think that a lot of these people, they don't like realize how good it can be without it. And like,
well, not only that, but it's different people too, Dave. I mean, if you were to smoke pot, what would happen?
I would smoke pot morning, noon, and night.
Right away.
And I don't know what the next thing would be, but there wouldn't be a day that I didn't smoke pot.
And then there would be something. There would be eventually be something, right?
I'd probably wind up taking a Xanax,
right.
You know,
okay.
Find a way to get some benzos.
That's right.
And then once that, and you know, then I would have to take them to avoid having seizures, because I had millions of seizures because I took too many benzos. And then maybe if somebody had a Percocet, I'd be like, all right, well, whatever. That's just the way I am.
Well, no, but it's all whatever, because, hey, I'm smoking pot, I'm handling it, I'm doing fine. I can handle some Xanax.
Exactly.
I'm fine. What if Chris had smoked pot? What would happen?
Probably the same thing.
Right.
But Chris wouldn't have smoked, you know, he wouldn't have smoked pot. Chris would have fucking scored, you know, he would have gone on the dark web and scored whatever he could and shot it and immediately.
Yeah.
But my other buddy, Todd, who was a heroin addict, went into sober living. And when he got out, he said, Dave, I just need to smoke pot. And I said, dude, there's no fucking way you're going to just smoke pot. And he said, I can just smoke weed. I said, okay. Within a month, he was dead.
Yeah.
You know, of a fentanyl probably based heroin overdose.
Yeah.
And he didn't even shoot dope. He barely did any. It was a tiny, tiny bit that killed him. And it was just because he wanted to smoke pot that got him there.
And
you know, that's
fair,
why I feel so strongly.
And to be fair, that's the risk of staying on cannabis replacement if you're an opiate addict, as opposed to Suboxone, say, if you're going to be on something, that's a lower risk. That's more likely to save your
absolutely.
Life.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I don't think he ever saw it coming up at him. And I don't think Chris ever saw it coming up at him either. I think as addicts, we're stubborn and we think we can handle a lot of stuff that we can't really handle.
That's right. Well, that's the disease. That's the distortions of the illness, which is why you don't make decisions with your brain that has the disorder, right? You can't be objective about your condition. What else you got, Susan?
Oh, my arms are getting tired.
Okay.
You're getting a lot of really nice compliments, and somebody said you need a TV show. Let's see.
Who, me or Dr. Drew?
I knew Dave was thinking
Drew.
That.
Let's see here. I had
Dr. Drew, don't you have a TV show?
Not right now. Well, I do Teen Mom, but that's about it. Right
yeah.
Now.
Why don't we get you a TV show? I've got a bunch of ideas.
All right.
Okay.
Let's talk about it.
If you can do it.
I'm thinking
somebody
about it.
Somebody asked you if you remember Al Bowman. I hope that doesn't mean something's wrong. Remember Al Bowman?
I do remember the name.
He was the guy that gave me the podcast award.
Oh, yeah, of course.
He was the guy who had the thing at the Whiskey A Go-Go.
Yep.
And,
yep.
I don't know. I hope he's okay. Does that mean?
I think they're just asking if we know him.
Oh, okay. Hold on. I have to scroll up. There was a question up here. Do you ever have online seminars? No, but
that
would
be a good idea. That's a good idea. That's a good idea. Dave, we ought to do like an online little something. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
I like
charge
that.
People to ask questions.
Or sort of a,
make
do,
money
sort of
doing
a,
this.
Sort of a comprehensive sort of little conversation about addiction. It's a really interesting idea.
Well, I mean, this is a way we want people to listen to our podcast. Yeah. And, you know, obviously this is just PR for our podcast.
No,
but,
no, but that could be more therapeutically oriented.
Yeah.
If you really did something comprehensive.
For people that are in recovery, AA question. This is from Natalie. Why all or nothing? Isn't AA like evangelical Christianity or Puritans? Why not have a program with people who want to get better and get off hard drugs and alcohol? I should be able to smoke pot versus antidepressants and still be sober.
I don't fully understand the question there.
I don't either.
Dave, but you want to take a crack at that?
Do you get it?
I like puritanical Christian cults, especially as a middle of the road, middle class liberal Jew.
That's funny.
Yeah, it's hard to get them to understand that it's not that. So.
It's not. It's more spiritual.
It's everything you don't want it to be if you don't want it to work.
Right.
It's everything bad if you don't want it to work.
Right.
And I was there. I didn't want it to work. And I was like, fuck you. Now I'm so happy to be a part of it. Like, it saved my life. You know, and I feel like a weird culty Christian person to say that.
Well, people always say it's not evidence-based. There's about to be a Cochrane review published by Dr. Kelly at Harvard that shows it is evidence-based, particularly when abstinence is your goal. It's as effective or more than any other treatment we have.
And it's free.
And it's free.
It's goddamn free.
And you can go anywhere.
Everyone's
anytime.
So worried about healthcare costs, and this is one of the most impactful way to reduce healthcare costs. Free, free, free. I can't say it strongly enough.
Go hear everybody else's problems.
I want to say one thing though that I didn't say, and I think it's very important because a lot of people, and I was one of them. They say go to a meeting, and you say, well, I went to a meeting, and I still want to use, and I still feel the same.
Yeah.
And the real trick about going to the meetings is actually working the program and doing the steps. It's like you can go to a meeting and it's not doing the work.
Right.
It's the steps that causes a spiritual change. It causes a change.
And let me, for people that get a little weird about that, what that is just a relationship with a sponsor. When he says doing the steps, he means you need to develop a very close relationship with somebody else who has been sober for a long time, who sits and listens to you and helps you with this process of staying sober. That's it. That's why I always say no sponsor, no treatment. No sponsor, no treatment. I say that all
right.
the time.
My sponsor is amazing, and I've had a few that have been incredibly helpful people to me. But the steps itself, it sounds really weird, but it clears out a channel in you. Like, that's the best way to describe it. It tore down the old structure in my mind, and it let me have a clean slate
to build a new foundation. It does it by building that in an interpersonal context. You do all of it with your sponsor, and that sponsor supports you through that process. It's just a relationship. It's like therapy. It's very much very structured. It works the same as any other professionally managed therapy, but it's for a very specific problem. Very specific thing. It's not
in the book. It's not so much about the sponsor as it is about the steps themselves. Why are you so gung-ho about the relationship aspect?
Because I do believe it's an interpersonal experience that you have. That's why it's so powerful. And I'm emphasizing it because people get weird about what you mean to follow these steps. They just get weird about it. It's back to your, hey man, you're trying to control me. It's back to that.
Right.
Stuff.
All right. I hear you. Yeah. Sponsors are great.
Last question, Susan. We got to wrap this thing up.
Yeah, this is one that's addressing parenthood.
Okay,
and I got to go back up to it. Hold on. Okay, she asked a long time ago. I don't know if she's even still on this feed because we've broken it a couple times. How honest, Lori says, how honest to be with a 4.5-year-old whose father is addicted to cocaine and alcohol, who will be going to jail for threatening his mom with a gun?
Well, this is kind of where we started the conversation, isn't it, Dave, with Mike? It's like, and so how do you, we talked about how to talk to somebody about recovery and a history of addiction. How do you talk to a child if a parent is actively addicted? It's hard.
Well, I think this person might be lucky that the guy goes to jail as opposed to stays in the house with that situation.
But he's going to why, mommy?
I would say something that I would get into the brain thing again. There's a brain condition. It makes him not in his right mind, and he loves you, but he is really not well right now. and it's making him do behaviors that, you know, and if you really want to get into it further, it's there's a
four and
he
a
took
half.
He took a substance. You know, you can't get too far into it.
They won't understand.
No, they won't.
But there must be like, well, she should go to Al-Anon first of all.
She should go to Al-Anon first of all.
And just, then maybe also connect with other parents that have the same problem.
I think at four you might want to just say he's sick and not well.
Daddy's sick.
Yeah,
How about he went on a trip?
Yeah. No, sick and not well. And is not.
But do you take the child to see the father in the jail?
Well,
no,
it's
right?
But the same thing you would do with any other criminal behavior. Yes, you would. Right, but you can at least wait.
But why he's in jail? Do you explain? He's got an. I mean, maybe you know what? Maybe you have to tell him. You can't really lie to your kids.
You don't lie. You just try to keep it to a minimum as they're young. Just be very and that they're safe. They're getting better. They love you. Those kinds of things are the important messages.
Right. So, well, yeah, maybe.
But
she
do
said,
answer the questions the best you can.
Well, and then the child probably experienced trauma because they were fighting, right?
Right.
So then she has to get the child therapy.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's what we would do.
Absolutely. But not everyone has access to that kind of stuff.
Well, she can go to social services.
And sometimes victim of violent crimes, you can get through services that way, through social services. So, yeah.
And through what's called
trauma-informed therapies. That's the kind of thing that child needs, yes. It's traumatic to have a parent with addiction.
That just suddenly disappears.
All traumatic. Abandonment.
Because if you make them the bad guy, then you're causing more problems.
Right. You don't want to get into dad's a bad person because the child feels responsible for everything. So the child's going to feel like it's because of them that the father disappeared, because of the child.
So you have to explain it.
You have to stay in the, you know, very, you know, sort of limited area of there's a sickness. He took a substance that affected his brain. He's not in his right mind.
I think therapy is the first step for both
therapy,
of them.
Absolutely. Al-Anon and therapy, absolutely.
And then 100%. Have them work through it.
100%.
If you can afford it, but there's ways of getting therapy.
Victims of violent crimes. You can get resources through that because there was a violent crime here. The guy attacked her with a gun.
Right, so, which is wrong, and he was high.
So, Dave, I'm going to wrap this thing up. I really do appreciate everything you're doing, as always. Keep fighting the good fight.
Thank you, Dr. Drew. It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on. I'd love to have you back on our show, too.
We do. And it's interesting. We're getting into stuff, conversations. You know, before, you and I just got into war stories and how amazing Chris's disease, how amazing his manifestations were when he was living in a psychiatric hospital, essentially, forever. And that he got well, and that this damn thing got him.
Well, we should get some more good guests together, and we'll see if we can, you know, solve all the world's problems. And as people were asking how Gary Busey's doing.
Gary's great. But we're getting into the zone, Dave, where we're talking about different kinds of recovery now, right? Because these diseases are so dangerous, there's people that are not necessarily going for abstinence-based treatment. And we want to help people with that kind of treatment as well as with full recovery.
Yeah, I'm trying to find a way to discuss it on my show without alienating anybody.
Yeah.
And I think that's the next phase of Dopey, is to really discuss different possibilities for anybody who's suffering with the stuff that we suffer with.
Exactly. It's exactly what I hope we did today. I hope we did something.
Yeah,
of that today.
Go listen to the Dopey podcast and
find dopeypodcast.com. You could check it out. We're on iTunes. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, Dave. It's always great to talk to you, man. See you in New York.
You live.
Yeah, cool.
All right, you live. See you away. See you next time, everybody. All right, that's about it for this episode of This Life. Check us out at KBC 790 Midday Live Talk Radio. Monday to Friday, you can also tune in every day live via the magic of the internet at kbc.com. If you miss it, we've made it simple for you to find all the shows at drdrew.com, the Adam and Dr. Drew podcast, the Zinc One I Do By Myself, Dr. Drew podcast, This Life, of course, with Bob Swole Patrol, Mike Cantho, and his new health and fitness podcast. You can find us on Twitter at This Life Podcast, at Dr. Drew, D-R-E-W, at Rehab Bob Forrest, and of course, our lovely producer at First Lady of Love. I think I know who that is. If you love this show, please subscribe and tell a friend. We appreciate it when you do. We'd love to hear your feedback as well. Send us a message. Join the email list at drdrew.com/contact. You'll also get a weekly email from us on that. While you're at it, at drdrew.com, please support our sponsors by clicking through the banners. We only advertise products that I can get behind. So thank you for supporting them, those that support us. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.